I'm going to go ahead and call the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, a quorum is present. I want to just first of all welcome everybody back. I know we've been looking forward to today and the start of session. And I don't have any trivia questions or chainsaw ideas about how we can have a big discussion this morning, but I did want to go ahead and start with, we have a few new committee staff that I'd like to point out. On the GOP side, we have Luke Lebrun, our partisan researcher. Thank you. And then Chair Fisher, I think you have a new CLA you might want to introduce.
Sure. I have a new CLA, Robin Mercer Taylor, who's over here.
Thank you. And then finally, I'd like to welcome our committee pages that are assigned to the committee for this year, Henry and Mira. So if you have something that you'd like to have some help with, they're ready to go and can assist you. As you know, we have a few new security and committee protocols in place. Each committee is going through those things as they meet for the first time. So if you've heard it, just bear with me. And if it's new, try to track the information. So we ask adherence to the following guidelines to maintain decorum and order. Signs and place cards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. I feel like those are things that have always been, but we're bringing it up just at the beginning. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed for safety reasons. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak to our Sergeant in Arms staff. They're fabulous. They have yellow ties on and they will assist you. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. So thank you for bearing with me through that. Just a reminder, I guess, really, more than anything else. We do have minutes in the packet, so hopefully you've had a chance to look at those, but I'm told that we've already addressed the minutes and they're already posted, so there's no action needed on that item. I'm not seeing any questions or concerns being raised, so I will start moving forward with a introduction to today's agenda. We're here today and we're going to hear from MPCA on PFAS. We'll go through their presentation and then hear from people that have signed up to testify. After that, we'll move to member questions. There's also a number of letters that are in your packet that may be helpful if folks are kind of going to glance through and see what has been submitted to the committee. So, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, MPCA, Tom Johnson, Director of Government Relations and External Affairs, MPCA. Looks like you both are ready and raring to go. So whoever wants to lead off, I will invite you to introduce yourself formally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Director of Government Relations and External Affairs at the Pollution Control Agency. With me today is Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka. I know we've got a lot of material to cover, so I'll start off here, go quickly through some background, and then pass it over to the Assistant Commissioner to talk through. I know there's particular interest in some of the Amara's Law implementation pieces, so we'll cover that in the second half of the presentation. But to start off, I know the committee is very familiar with PFAS, but for those at home or unfamiliar, PFAS is a per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances class of human-made fluorinated organic chemicals containing at least one fluorinated carbon atom. That's the definition in statute. These are a very large class of chemicals. I feel like the number increases every time we look. I think one of the written testimony submitted referenced 12,000, so I think that might be the latest number, but they are characterized by long carbon-fluorine chains of bonds, and those bonds are the strongest in organic chemistry. That gives PFAS certain characteristics that are very desirable. They are water-resistant, fire-resistant, and therefore very helpful in both industrial applications and have made their way into consumer products over time. So the same characteristics that make them very desirable, heat resistance, water resistance, et cetera, make them very difficult to break down in the environment. And that is part of the issue. They're very persistent in the environment. They are also have been linked to a number of health effects, including multiple cancers, thyroid impacts, et cetera. Here's just a picture of sort of how PFAS move around in the environment. They are considered bioaccumulative and highly mobile. There are impacts not only in the production of PFAS chemicals themselves, there are impacts potentially when products are created using PFAS, but also there are impacts when or potential contamination that's a result of use at our homes or the waste when we throw it away, or certainly it moves between, once it is in the environment, soil, groundwater, and into surface water through the fish. It's a bioaccumulative toxin. Though PFAS is a global issue, we have a much longer history in Minnesota with these chemicals than other states. Our journey began with the discovery of two types of PFAS in the East Metro that I know the committee is familiar with. PFAS were first discovered in those drinking water supplies in 2004. Additional investigation has found PFAS all across Minnesota. It is not just an East Metro problem. At least 20 community water systems require treatment for PFAS to meet federal safety standards. That's our estimate at the time, but we believe there may be additional ones. About half of those are outside the East Metro. Groundwater samples at over 100 closed landfill sites across Minnesota exceed the Department of Health's health risk limits for PFAS. And private wells continue to be a concern. MPCA treats thousands of private wells associated with PFAS releases. Just in the East Metro alone, covered under the 3M settlement, we have issued over 3,000 well advisories and have provided bottled water to those folks and in-home treatment at about 1,500 of those homes. If we have a known release and exceedance, we ask the responsible party to provide treatment, or the state incurs those costs when we are not able to find a responsible party. That has been a challenge with PFAS because they stick around for so long and move around in the environment. We have found plumes where it's either not, we're not able to identify a single responsible party, as in there's multiple potential ones, or the responsible party is long defunct and we're not able to recover any costs from those. For these types of situations, the governor has included a recommendation for general obligation bonds and general fund cash to help MPCA address drinking water concerns for private well owners. We have a program that was set up last year. Appreciate the legislature's work on that. Overall, though, estimated drinking water costs at this time are over $1 billion to the state. And that includes treatment, but also investigation and remedial actions. And the MPCA commissioned a report in 2023 to look at the overall cost to the state if we were to remove and destroy PFAS from wastewater and biosolids in Minnesota. And those numbers are in the double-digit billions for the state. And I'm sure especially those on the Capital Investment Committee are seeing those requests for both drinking water and wastewater coming through. The good news is we do have a plan to address PFAS in Minnesota. In 2021, Minnesota published the PFAS Blueprint. This is not just a Minnesota Pollution Control Agency document, but was built in collaboration with the Departments of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. The blueprint itself is comprised of 10 issue papers covering a broad range of topics from PFAS pollution prevention to remediation practices. And just a further breakdown of that on this next slide, we like to say at the MPCA that there are three ways that you can address pollution. You can prevent it, you can manage it, or you can clean it up. And those get progressively more expensive as you move along that continuum. So I'll talk a little bit first about some cleanup examples, move to management, and then we'll talk about pollution prevention. I'll pass it to the assistant commissioner. But as I mentioned, the 3M settlement and the East Metro is the most prominent example of cleanup efforts. $850 million settlement with 3M in the state of Minnesota. That's 16 communities with pretty significant contamination. The focus in some communities is on those in-home treatment systems for private wells rather than on the community water systems, but there are over $300 million earmarked for capital investments and many other projects needed to be completed, but we're well on our way in that effort. The other thing I want to acknowledge and really appreciate the investment from the legislature was $25 million appropriated in 2023. This was for drinking water planning and design. As I mentioned, a lot of cities and communities are entering this point where they're identifying PFAS as a contamination in their drinking water wells, either their municipal wells or their private wells. And so getting money out to folks to help design new treatment facilities has led to, I think, the number of bonding requests coming in that will eventually help address PFAS in those communities and get clean and safe drinking water to those communities. The other piece of this, so that was about $20 million for 14 projects. $4.5 million of this was site investigations, and this is really how we've continued to identify and try to find responsible parties to pay for cleanup at where there are contamination issues. And this money has been spent, and unfortunately, the work will slow down in this area, but it has been really an incredible opportunity to, when we identify PFAS, which we're obviously identifying a lot of it, we've been able to investigate and try to find the responsible party there. Moving on to PFAS management, a lot of this work is informed by the PFAS monitoring plan, which is really a foundation of this work. The monitoring plan was designed to coordinate short-term initiatives to understand potential sources of PFAS to Minnesota's waste streams and environment. We worked with facilities where monitoring for PFAS would help us determine where, how, and why these chemicals are entering the environment. And we specifically focused on facilities that we believed had a higher likelihood of PFAS use or a release in the environment. So this was really a partnership across state government, local government, and private industry to make this possible. Ultimately, over 200 facilities representing a variety of sectors sampled for PFAS. We published those initial findings and next steps in May of 2024. And as one would expect, PFAS were found at many of the facilities where sampling was conducted. Based on the findings of the monitoring plan, the MPCA took quick action in cases where there are immediate risks, but overall, this was informed a longer-term permitting approach that I'll talk about a little bit in a minute. But also want to recognize the $4.2 million that the legislature appropriated also for source identification and reduction and treatment grants. So these were grants that we were able to give in many cases to the folks who had been monitoring with us for the PFAS monitoring plan to help them move up the stream and identify where that source was, whether it was an industrial source or a waste source or an old contamination site, whatnot. And then we were also able to provide some limited grant opportunities for innovative treatment options, including pyrolysis, foam fractionation, supercritical water oxidation, and then sort of the more traditional methods of reverse osmosis and granulated activated carbon treatments. Information from the PFAS monitoring plan, as I mentioned, has also helped us begin to include PFAS in and or either limits or monitoring requirements in permits. These limits remain rare, but require permit holders to limit the amount of specific PFAS types in effluent. So a couple examples include the Bemidji wastewater treatment facility permit. We also have the 3M Cottage Grove permit has an industrial limit. We also have an industrial wastewater, we also have an industrial stormwater general permit with monitoring requirements and certain thresholds for action. To speak a little bit finally about the biosolids strategy that the MPCA was directed to undertake by the legislature, we really followed the great work that was done by other states as well and aligned that with other states like Michigan who have who have addressed biosolids in their state as well. The idea was to require testing of biosolids, and then based on the levels, they would fall into a certain tier. Based on the levels or what tier they fall into, then it would determine whether or not those facilities are able to land apply those biosolids. About 20% of biosolids from wastewater treatment facilities are applied to farmland, so it is really important that we test and determine what's appropriate. The good news is only zero facilities were at the highest level, tier four, which are not allowed to land apply. We have not found a facility yet or biosolids that meet that very high level of PFAS threshold. We do have a number of facilities, a small number of facilities at the tier three, that middle tier, which have elevated amounts, but we're working with them to limit the amount that they're land applying, and they're doing source identification to find the source of those PFAS. And then there's the tier two where some PFAS is found. In those cases, those facilities still need to do source identification, but they do not have a limit on their land application. And then more of the facilities, the greatest amount of facilities fall into the lowest level, tier one, luckily, which is still some PFAS, of course. We're finding that everywhere, but we still are allowing those folks to land apply. And we are still encouraging them to do source identification, but their biosolids are low enough that they can continue their work of land applying where needed. So with that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'll pass it on to Assistant Commissioner Kadelka.
Assistant Commissioner, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for having us here. As mentioned in the blueprint, we really talk about three ways and how we can address PFAS. And it's become very evident we cannot clean our way out of this. And that's where pollution prevention, reducing PFAS at the source, is really our best way to get our arms around PFAS in Minnesota and the nation as a whole. And we're really looking at what are those non-essential uses of PFAS? How do we remove those from our systems, our environment, our economies? The next slide really talks about and shows you what that cost differential is. So as you can see here, there is a cost of about $50 to $1,000 to purchase a pound of PFAS to use, say, in a manufacturing setting. But the costs are in the millions, anywhere from close to $3 to $18 million to clean up that same pound once it gets out into the system. So this is not only for those direct impacts that you can think of, human health and the ingestion and that, or into our wildlife, our fish and populations, for instance, but it's also about our economy. It's the cost and additional increases in our water bills as consumers and residents of Minnesota to clean it up. It's the cost in the healthcare industry as we are seeing those health impacts being felt by individuals and industries as they may be getting PFAS from others that they're unaware of and having pulling on those liabilities. So there's costs throughout the system. And so in Minnesota, the next slide talks really about a suite of efforts that various leadership from both parties have helped us advance Minnesota's PFAS laws. You can see we really started out looking at PFAS in firefighting foam, AFFF, and prohibited that in testing and really then moving that up to all uses, and happy to report now that all airport use of AFFF, the PFAS with firefighting foam, is no longer used, for airports, except for a very small case where we still have a little bit more time for hangars at one airport. So this has gone along very well. Earlier, too, even before Amara's Law, which I'll get to in a second, the legislature passed a prohibition on PFAS intentionally added into food packaging, and we're moving through that, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And then what we call the suite of products, which is really three components of Amara's Law. Starting in 2015, a number of products, 2025, a number of products, 11 product categories where intentionally added PFAS are prohibited. We're moving into the July 1st, 2026 PFAS reporting of intentionally added PFAS in products, and then ultimately moving away from PFAS in non-essential uses on January 1st of 2032, where all products that have intentionally added PFAS that do not receive a currently unavoidable use determination would be prohibited. So that first part of the system we talked about is the this is a comprehensive system and a way to handle it. As you can see, we are phasing it in various categories, but the long-term goal is moving away from non-essential uses of PFAS. There's additional flexibility and other components in there. As we look at the prohibitions here under Amara's Law, I want to just start off with those in 2025, and that's these 11 product categories. You can see it's everywhere from cookware to carpets to ski wax. Now, those watching the Olympics may have heard that the Olympic competitors, those that had PFAS in their products, were actually disqualified because of the use, because of the concern of PFAS. So you can see how this is a worldwide effort to reduce the use of PFAS. Overall, we have really seen collaboration from manufacturers and retailers, where we have a widespread availability of products without PFAS in these 11 product categories. If you walk through your favorite department store, you've probably seen changes in the shelves, but you still see, for instance, the cookware there. There are just different types of cookware. There are other types of ski wax along the line. So for most consumers, this is a seamless transition. As I mentioned, we have the 2024 prohibition on PFAS in food packaging. And this is where we've moved forward and started doing some sampling to test where we are spot checks on various types of packaging. And most cases are not finding PFAS in the food packaging. Where there are situations, we do follow up with the manufacturer. There's a recent example where we followed up with a manufacturer selling into Minnesota. They not only changed what they were doing in Minnesota, but the benefits were felt worldwide because they moved the packaging without PFAS in it for everyone. And so that's a really great legacy here and a benefit that Minnesota change here has driven it across the world as we continue to move forward. And we are right now looking through the 2025 prohibitions. Right after the date changed on the 1st, on January 1st of 2025, we really worked on education and outreach. But we're now transitioning to that spot checking, much like we've done to food packaging, to see where there may be products that do have PFAS still in them. We've been working on a number of complaints. We often get referrals in about various products, and so we have reached out to our first companies to talk to them, to bring them into compliance, where they have a product that was under the 2025 prohibition, and we are now bringing them into compliance to make sure that they're no longer selling that in Minnesota. The next milestone here is July 1st, and that is the reporting on intentionally added PFAS in the products. And so these next couple ones, we're going to spend a little bit more time. I know there's a lot of interest, and just because the deadline is coming up here. So overall, the benefits of reporting PFAS in products, there are three main ones I want to focus on. One is for people purchasing products, whether it's an individual consumer or a business, to understand whether or not PFAS is in it so they can make decisions on how to move forward. So if you're looking to buy an O-ring and you have a number of different models, but you know half of them have PFAS and half don't, if I want to continue to move forward in the sale in Minnesota and other states that are prohibiting the use of PFAS, they know those businesses can plan ahead today, put it into their product, and not have to change it later. This allows them to be proactive in their efforts. For consumers, they can then decide if they want to avoid PFAS for a multiple variety of reasons they may have. The second effort is really getting this set up for 2032. Businesses that are not already prohibited for their use of PFAS by that point have to remove it from their product and go down that pathway, and knowing what where it is and what function it's playing is a very key first step, a milestone for them along that journey. If they were to make a request for a currently unavoidable use, for instance, saying that is an essential use of PFAS, they need this information too to be able to make their case as we move forward to see at 2032 if they would still be able to use PFAS in select circumstances. So very beneficial milestone for businesses. The third is really helping how do we do policy development. So for instance, if we were to get a number of information, a certain type of medical devices that are heavily using PFAS, the agency can then look at what technical resources or financial resources and work with the legislature to help provide those industries move away from PFAS. One example is we did receive a grant from EPA on pollution prevention, and we've been working with the U of M to provide technical assistance to businesses who want to move away from PFAS in a certain sector. That's one of the benefits of this type of information. So the information that's collected has been known since its passage in the middle of 2023, and it's four items. What is your product, a description of it, what type of PFAS, the name for the PFAS that's in your product, how much is in that product, and then finally, what is the function? So this is something that manufacturers, and started in 2023, by the time they have to report in the middle of this year, they will have 3 full years to collect that information on their products. So at the end of last year, we completed a rulemaking on this effort, and the rulemaking had a lot of participation. 90 various parties participated in the public comment process, good information that we were able to use as we were adopting this rule. A couple things that I want to highlight is we were able to build in flexibility listening to a number of folks. For instance, how do we group similar types of products? How do we allow for maybe a supplier to report on the PFAS in a product instead of the end manufacturer? So how does that relationship work out to make it easier for folks to move forward? How do you report PFAS in ranges of concentrations versus knowing the exact amount? And then have specific items that I'll talk a little bit more about are trade secrets, and then we have options for extensions and waivers. The cost for a manufacturer to enter into this program is $800, and that is for all the products in their line. So it is a very small cost, but it is needed to help offset the expenses for the program. And as I mentioned, this will be starting reporting on July 1st. One of those questions we got during the rulemaking and concerns, and one that we share too, is how do we protect sensitive data? And so we're doing this a couple ways. One, specifically in the rule, we've built in, so if the name of a specific chemical, PFAS chemical, is a trade secret, you can go into the system and bump up to the class above it so that it is more aggregate amount. That exact PFAS chemical is not named in the materials. In addition, I talked about the concentrations. We have various categories that you can put in. My concentration of PFAS is within this range, so the exact amount is not known. As you go into the system, the material is put into the system, but it doesn't automatically go out to the public reporting system. The agency then reviews it. For instance, if you flagged that you are going to report on that higher class name of PFAS or for other situations. In addition, the general data protection laws apply here too. So if there is some other request that a person has a belief that it follows under the law for trade secret protection, they can make those requests. Again, as data is put into the agency, it does not go directly to the public portal. It allows for the agency to look at these reports and make sure that we're protecting data as we go before it's released. So a little bit on our system, which is called PRISM. This is built off a system that other states use to report other types of chemicals in products. So for instance, Washington and Oregon use this system. We've built out a module for PFAS reporting to be used not only in Minnesota, but the goal is for other states that are having reporting requirements to be able to use this the same software, making it easier for manufacturers as we move into the future with the PFAS regulations across the nation. So we launched it fully in January of 2026. The system is fully operational. We've already had two reports come in through the system. Folks are signing up. We have about 300 folks that have signed up already into the system. So people are becoming familiar with it as they are starting to get ready for the July 1st date. We have made an announcement that we will have version 1.1 in the end of this month. That's going to make some updates that we've put online because of comments we heard when we did a soft launch in December and January of this year. And an example is product components. There are questions about the drop-down lists we have. We're going to have it in an open field so people can just type in their components, making it much easier for them to be able to match the uniqueness of their products but still provide the information to the public. One of the things we've heard from feedback is as we've been making changes, we haven't necessarily done the best job of saying those changes that have gone into effect. So we're going to also, at this time of the release, outline what are those improvement enhancements that we've made so folks can understand it. A good example is the macro and the template that is built in here. We made those changes in response to our soft launch and some concerns we had. We made those changes for the full launch in January. We weren't very public about it, but those changes were made to make the system better on behalf of what we've heard from the feedback. So the next couple slides just wants to give a little view here of the system. This slide really just wants to highlight there's two ways in. One will allow for folks to be able to search products to be able to determine if there's PFAS there. This is for businesses and members of the public. This is very sparse right now. We just have our first one that we've approved to go through this. The other side of the portal is where manufacturers go in and enter the data. And so you can see here is an example we have in one of our support documents on what this system looks like with some sample data that's put in there. You can tell it's about 10 data fields that we ask for each of the components information, stuff that I mentioned earlier, those four categories. Description of your product, that's a number of the early fields. Then what is the name of the PFAS, what is its function, and what is its range? So it's not a complex system. It's, as I mentioned, we've got two different reports already in. The interface in that is actually simpler than, say, the RETRAC system that counties use for reporting solid waste system data into us annually. So we do know that there's and some folks have a number of products that they have to report. So it's not that you just have to go in here and enter them one by hand. We have a template, a spreadsheet, which folks can upload the information into so they can have their databases, which is collecting this information that they've been amassing since 2023. They can then put this into their, download it into the template and load it all up there. So it's not someone going through each ways. We understand that there's some folks have talked not only about the volume entries, but maybe they don't have 100% of the data. So we do understand the first reports that come in on July 1st will not be perfect. You know, we have expectations that folks are going to continue to collect this information the last 3 years and be able to provide that to the system. And we've made changes in the system to allow for this. For instance, in the frequently asked questions section, there are little fields that say, for instance, unknown at this time, if it's the function of the PFAS and the like. The responsibility of manufacturers is to provide as much information as possible, but we do know in some cases that, for instance, there may be 95% of the data there on this first report. The due diligence requirement in the rule does mean that they do have to provide that when they have that information when they receive it. So we anticipate more information come February 1st when it's reported again for the next year. So with that, I'm going to shift to our next conversation here, which is about the currently unavoidable use rulemaking, and this is looking ahead at 2032. So there are a couple goals that we really want to make sure we hit as we develop this rule, because it is very important to a number of folks, the public and manufacturers. The public wanted to be able to follow along and be able to comment on the process, and manufacturers wanted to understand what is the process, specifically what information is going to be needed to be considered, and what is the timelines for that to move forward. And so we've opened up a number of opportunities for engagement on this. An example is we've opened up the request for comments already for the rulemaking. We've had some check-in group conversations, and I'll highlight in a little bit here some more dates that are coming up. But the key to this rulemaking really is a very small piece of text that's in the statute, which is a currently unavoidable use. You can see there we're really having to answer a number of questions. What is essential for health, safety, and the function of society? What are alternatives? How do we determine that they are appropriate? And then are they reasonably available? And so this is the concepts that we are working on today. As I mentioned here, the rulemaking, we've started out a little bit earlier with the request for comments. We're going to, in this year here, continue to work and fine-tune the actual language for the rule, build out the statement of need and reasonableness for it. And throughout that, we're going to have a few check-ins with the general public, for instance, later this month, a webinar, and an opportunity for feedback using smart comments on concepts that we will be presenting to them, and a few other check-ins as we continue through the rulemaking process. So the next couple deadline, next couple dates that I think folks are very interested on is that February 26th webinar. We had a great interest in this. We had a registration system with the technology. We had a 1,000 entry limit. We went past that already, so we've opened it up to a live streaming on YouTube, just because there is a lot of interest in this, and we want this to be a very open and transparent process. We are going to talk about some of those concepts we mentioned earlier about what is essential for public safety and human health and the like. We're going to talk about how do you do the alternatives determinations, what does that process look like, well, where are currently unavoidable uses. And so we'll talk about that on the 26th and then open up 30 days for feedback using smart comments, for everyone to be able to start to weigh in on what are the things they think, this is a good idea, this one maybe needs a tweak, have you considered these type of things? This will allow for us to better fine-tune the actual rule language. We'll have another check-in in fall where we'll share what we've done because of that feedback, and then plan to do so again in the winter as we continue to move forward for 2027, where we would be able to propose the rules and release the full statement of need and reasonableness. We just do want to let folks know there will be a little lull in our work on this due to our reporting efforts in July, and so we have a team that is working on both of these, so we'll be really working on the outreach and education and helping folks through the reporting system. That will be their main focus during that period around July. So with that, Chair and committee members, we're done with our presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And I know that members are going to have questions, so just stand by. There's going to be testimony, and then I'm sure we'll get an opportunity to come back. So next up, we have Emily Jones. And after that, it'll be Ben. So Ben, if you want to get on deck. Emily, if you could make your way to the testifier's desk, that'd be great. Jones, if you could introduce yourself for the record and begin your comments, that'd be great. I have not written in any specific timeline, but generally I'm just going to advise testifiers to keep it to about 5 minutes-ish. So go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Emily Jones. I'm the Director of Energy and Environment Policy at the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which represents America's automakers. I'm here to talk generally about the launch of the PRISM system. The auto innovators were a participant in the soft launch, and I just have to start by saying, I know I only have 5 minutes, so I will be as concise as possible. PRISM, as launched, is not capable of supporting lawful compliance by the statutory deadline for our industry. We participated in the soft launch in good faith. We provided specific defect reports, and we saw no meaningful correction before the hard launch. The result is a system that creates compliance risk rather than enabling compliance and puts manufacturers in an impossible position, meeting a deadline that the state's own platform cannot reliably support. Vehicles are complex durable goods comprised of approximately 30,000 components, each designed to remain in service for many years. Managing the manufacture, distribution, and sourcing of these parts requires navigating a highly intricate global supply chain, often with automotive manufacturers 10 tiers removed from the original raw material suppliers. Based on Minnesota's regulations, we estimate that up to 3,000 components in every vehicle contain reportable substances. These chemicals are selected for their essential technical properties, including durability under extreme conditions, resistance to temperature and chemicals, low flammability, flexibility, fluid resistance, and lightweight. Shortened reporting deadlines, legacy product requirements, and limited system capabilities create considerable obstacles. Small system discrepancies become much larger when scaled across thousands of components, different vehicle types, and continuing service commitments. I'd like to give the committee an overview of some of the issues we identified during the soft launch of the PRISM system. Auto Innovators submitted a list of 45 identifiable issues of the PCA, which you have a copy of, none of which seem to have been fixed prior to the hard launch of the system on January 30th, 2026. I've provided the committee the documentation, but I will give you a high-level overview of the concerns, which fall into three buckets: insufficient timing and support, unclear and contradictory reporting guidance, and system design flaws. This is by no means an exhaustive list, as we continue to identify new issues as the rollout continues. In December 2025, the PCA contacted participants seeking volunteers to take part in the soft launch. In response, we promptly submitted names and inquired about the expected timeline to ensure our industry could adequately prepare and participate effectively. Initially, the soft launch was supposed to begin December 15th and run through January 12th. However, the system was not released to participants until after close of business on December 16th. During the soft launch, technical support was largely unavailable, with PCA indicating that email support would be unavailable from December 22nd through 26th, and PRISM's technical support returning an out-of-office response from December 17th through the 29th. The lack of functional technical support during the soft launch materially undermined the purpose of the exercise and prevented meaningful validation of the system prior to the hard launch. As a result, industry participants were unable to test end-to-end reporting, identify systemic defects, or prepare internal IT systems with confidence. We also identified several areas where the guidance in the system did not align. For example, guidance on component-level reporting is inconsistent. One section of the guidance document states that reporting should be done at the lowest practical component level that allows the PFAS use and function to be understood. The guidance further references the example of a car radio where the reporter is expected to break the assembly into subcomponents such as circuit board and coated wire. However, this level of detail is not supported by the current component list available in PRISM, leading to uncertainty about whether PCA expects reporting at the subcomponent level, assembly level, or something in between. During the soft launch period, we brought these inconsistencies to the attention of PCA and requested clarification. However, no response or acknowledgement regarding the discrepancy was received. These types of contradictions create a compliance risk, as we cannot determine with certainty whether we are reporting at the level of detail required by the regulation or merely at the level permitted by the system. Finally, the system itself presents several significant design flaws that we and other stakeholders flagged during the soft launch. We were unable to execute a successful test during the soft launch due to persistent validation errors that prevented the upload of the spreadsheet, which we tested after January 30th and do still exist. Yet when the same data was manually entered into PRISM, it was accepted and validated without issue. Repeated requests for technical support went unresolved, rendering the entire testing window ineffective and leaving industry participants unprepared for implementation. At the end of the soft launch, we had identified 1,900 missing substances from the system and were unable to reconcile the component list with what we understood from the guidance. This volume of missing data underscores that the system is still in an iterative development phase, not a production-ready compliance platform suitable for statutory enforcement. PCA has indicated in their own communication and said today that there is a planned change to the drop-down validation menu, but we don't know when this change will be implemented or how it will impact our data collection. Preparation for a data request of this magnitude requires a significant amount of IT prep, but we cannot plan for a system we have not seen. If you have a basic idea of numbers, 3,500 component parts times the 14 columns that are asked for times approximately 14 vehicle models per manufacturer is over 350,000 unique fields of data. As long as there are drop-down menus, we cannot copy and paste that data into the system. Absent a delay, the current timeline creates a high likelihood of widespread technical noncompliance despite good faith efforts by manufacturers and risks undermining both the credibility and enforceability of the program. During the delay period, industry can work together with PCA to identify a path forward for implementation that gets to the heart of the law, which right now we do not have the time to do before July 1st. Thank you for your time and your consideration of this issue.
Thank you. Mr. Wagner, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Ben Wagner. I serve as the Interim Director of Government Affairs and Communications for Medical Alley. For more than 40 years, Medical Alley has represented the leading healthcare and technology organizations in every corner of the state of Minnesota whose impact truly is felt around the world. Our mission is to activate and to amplify healthcare transformation. In 2023, as members of this committee know, the legislature passed Amara's Law, and during that debate, lawmakers saw fit to exempt medical devices, recognizing both the rigorous federal oversight provided by the FDA and the life-saving nature of these products. However, medical device manufacturers remain subject to the reporting requirements under the law, and today I want to share some of the concerns some of our partner companies are raising as they engage in the testing of the PRISM system, along with the broader concerns about data privacy, classification, and public disclosure. I want to start by acknowledging this. Implementing this legislation is complex, and we truly appreciate the coordination and the willingness to engage from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as PRISM has been developed. That said, though, the PRISM software in its current form is not ready to handle the scope and the technical complexity of the reporting required under the statute and the proposed rules. Companies participating in testing have consistently identified technical challenges that have been raised here today as well, including incomplete drop-down menus, unclear product definitions, missing component categories, system errors that cannot be resolved, updates that erase previously entered information, and functionality gaps that make compliance uncertain. These issues create risk not only in delayed reporting, but of potentially inaccurate reporting. Beyond the technical readiness, we also have concerns about data privacy and classification. It is our understanding that under Minnesota Data Practices Law, information submitted into PRISM is presumed public until a company affirmatively requests non-public classification. The MPCA would then evaluate those requests and make individual determinations. That framework raises several important questions, including what happens to data while classification decisions are pending, what is the expected timeline for those determinations, is submitted information accessible for review during that period, does the agency have sufficient technical expertise and staffing to evaluate highly specialized proprietary medical technology data at scale? And what recourse exists if a company disagrees with that classification decision? Medical technology companies invest years and significant resources to research, to develop, patent, test, and then to secure FDA clearance for devices that improve and save lives. They are now being asked to submit detailed technical information to a system that has not yet clearly defined how that data will be categorized, protected, or ultimately disseminated. And finally, we want to urge caution regarding how complex technical data may be interpreted once it is made public. Medical devices, as all of you know, are highly specialized technologies used within specific clinical contexts. Data that lacks context can be misunderstood or mischaracterized. In healthcare, misinformation has real consequences for patients, for providers, and for companies alike. And if information is released, it must be accurate, appropriately classified, and properly contextualized. The medical device and technology industry wants to make sure that this legislation is implemented in a way that protects innovation, safeguards proprietary information, and avoids unintended consequences. And given the technical readiness and the unresolved data classification questions, we respectfully request consideration of an extension of the reporting deadline to July 1st of 2027 or further legislative discussion regarding the reporting framework. I want to emphasize we remain committed to working collaboratively with the MPCA and the legislature to resolve this matter. Thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions over.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll probably have a few questions shortly, so
thank you.
Again, stand by. Nora Strandy. Please introduce yourself for the record, as you know, and start your testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Heintzman, Co-Chair Fisher, and members of the committee. My name is Nora Strandy. My older sister, Amara, passed away in April 2023, just before Minnesota passed the world's most comprehensive ban on PFAS, titled Amara's Law. When Amara testified in support of this PFAS bill in 2023, she called out industry. She encouraged these multi-billion dollar corporations to be part of the solution to ending the global PFAS crisis. I am here to ask the same today. Since the passage of Amara's Law, Minnesota has been a global leader in PFAS legislation. Australia, France, Italy, and Japan all have their eyes on Minnesota, and the world depends on Minnesota to stay strong on Amara's Law. These countries are seeking to pass similar legislation, and they are telling Minnesota's story across the world. We are leading in what's right, protecting our environment and saving lives. Every year, companies, not unlike the ones you'll hear from today, spend hundreds of millions of dollars on corporate lobbyists to fly across our country and claim that Minnesota's Amara's Law is a failure. This is an attempt to slow down the progress Minnesota and the world are making. These corporations have every resource at their fingertips to comply with our laws. But this is a long-used tactic for them to keep using what's most profitable for them as long as they can. These companies know that if they slow down compliance with Amara's Law, they can slow down regulation for the rest of the world. Instead of spending money on lobbyists trying to gut bills like Amara's Law, these corporations could use that money to comply with our laws to help us build a safer future without PFAS. The July reporting deadline isn't here yet. These companies still have time. A legislative fix is not appropriate, as concerns about reporting can be addressed during the rulemaking process. We are getting mixed messages from these multi-billion dollar companies. They claim to create the best products with the most up-to-date technologies, and yet they can't figure out a spreadsheet. We are hearing a lot of what cannot be done by companies that claim to be able to tackle some of the biggest challenges in the world in the fields of health, auto manufacturing, and more. The bottom line is that these chemicals affect people. They kill people. And Minnesotans deserve to know what is in their products. We all know PFAS is dangerous. Delaying a reporting period doesn't change that, nor does it change our rights as consumers to know what we are consuming. Thank you for your time.
Next up, we have Philip Johnson. Mr. Johnson, if you could, as others have, introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your comments.
Chair Heintzman, Chair Fisher, and members of the Environmental Committee, good afternoon and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Philip Johnston. I am the Vice President of the Environmental Promotion Office at Daikin Applied Americas, and I've spent more than 30 years working as an engineer. I'm here today on behalf of Daikin Applied, a Minnesota-based manufacturer headquartered in Plymouth, Minnesota. Daikin Applied Americas has operated in Minnesota since acquiring McQuay International in 2006, and McQuay was founded in 1930. We design, manufacture, and distribute essential air conditioning, heating, and ventilation equipment used in schools and universities, multifamily housing, hospitals, data centers, manufacturing facilities, and commercial buildings. We operate three manufacturing facilities in southern Minnesota. We employ more than 3,000 Minnesotans and rely on a supply network of way over 1,000 suppliers, including many Minnesota businesses. Daikin Applied, or DAA, supports Minnesota's goals of protecting human health and the environment and are committed to compliance. However, as a company that builds essential and highly complex equipment, we are concerned that the current aggressive reporting timeline and missing functionality in the reporting system create a substantial risk of disruption to in-state manufacturing and sales. DAA manufactures complex equipment made up of thousands of individual components. Those components come from a multi-tier supply chain, which extends well beyond Minnesota and well beyond the United States of America. Under the current approach, our ability to continue manufacturing products depends on whether our upstream suppliers are able to successfully navigate the PRISM reporting system within a very compressed timeline. If suppliers are unable to report, the most likely outcome is that they stop selling into Minnesota. When that happens, DAA does not just face a reporting issue, but loses access to essential components. And without those components, manufacturing Minnesota stops. The timeline for reporting significantly increases this risk. The system only recently became available, yet complete and accurate reports with an unprecedented, until all information is known, level of due diligence are due by July 1. This would be the first reporting obligation of this magnitude to come due in the United States, even as both EPA and Maine have scaled back similar requirements after recognizing practical implementation challenges. DAA already has considerable experience in this type of data gathering and reporting in order to comply with Canadian reporting requirements. After monthly communication with only our largest 225 suppliers, of, again, way more than 1,000, and focusing on our top 55,000 most purchased parts, we have observed a limited response rate of only 39.7%. In addition, the reported data was not as robust as the full scope of information and the MCPA rule, such as CAS numbers, function of the material, etc. For manufacturers of complex products with many, many suppliers, this time frame is not sufficient to identify in-scope components, collect data across multiple global supplier tiers, reconcile inconsistencies, and successfully upload large data sets, particularly while the system itself is still being refined. Equally important is the functionality of the reporting system itself. When we participated in the soft open review period, we found that the instructions are unclear and there's only a single reporting template with no version number or date, making it impossible to know whether the correct or most current version is actually being used. The template does not align well with commercial and complex products. Key component categories are missing or are poorly aligned with how products are actually manufactured. There are no complete lists or clear definitions for the pre-populated fields, leaving many required terms ambiguous and open to interpretation. Furthermore, validation errors are difficult to diagnose because the template does not clearly identify where errors occur or how they can be corrected. The system also provides no practical way to group related products or components, which is especially problematic for the thousands of shared parts between our many, many product lines. These challenges are compounded when uploading large data sets, making compliance far more difficult than necessary and increasing the likelihood of reporting errors, delays, and supplier disengagement. DAA respectfully urges the MPCA to extend the reporting deadline 12 months or more and continue improving system functionality before requiring full compliance. Doing so will allow manufacturers and our suppliers to provide more accurate information, reduce the risk of supply chain disruption, and ensure that manufacturing Minnesota may continue without interruption. I thank you very much for your time and for this opportunity to share our thoughts on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. I'm just going to lead off on questions. You can go ahead and stand by, and I'm going to call back PCA. If they could answer a question quickly, that might help. Sure. And I have Schultz, Nelson, Hansen, Warwas, Burkle, Purcell, and Gilman. And we'll start with a quick question I might have that could help members and maybe some folks in the audience as well. To either testifier, I'm just hoping we could maybe get a response. A lot of the testimony we heard centered around reporting and some of the challenges with PRISM. Specifically, my attention peaked when I'm hearing Ms. Jones from Alliance for Automotive Innovation talk about some of the challenges that they have faced, and it was pretty detailed, pretty specific, and I'd like to believe that your enhanced version that you mentioned was just going to address all those things, but I'm more than concerned. I just wanted to give you a chance to address it before we get going.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record again, my name is Kirk Adalka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We are moving forward to make updates as we move forward. We announced that there would be the version 1.1 that would come out at the end of the month. In our announcement in January, we specifically said that the drop-down box for product categories would be made in open text. Very clear about making that change. It is in beta testing right now and will be available with the changes as we move forward. There are other parts in here, for instance, the items that are in various drop-down menus. Those are options for us to add as we go. For instance, the types of PFAS. If there's a new PFAS out there, we can add that into the system and make that available in real time, not having to wait for a larger change. And that this goes to really show why we need this reporting system is. There are PFAS that are being used in commerce that we don't even know about. And being able to have this reporting system let us know what it is, we can put it in the drop-down box to allow for others to do. So there are a number of changes that we are making as we move and continue to make the enhancements as we move forward. There are some of the asks, though, that are things that have been noted before and we've answered. We've received many questions about things that we've explained, and including the list here provided by the auto manufacturers, such as what is the fee and how is that applied to manufacturers. There are also sometimes requests by folks that are nice-to-haves, that adding more detail or complexity to the system makes it more complex for everyone else. It may work for this manufacturer, but it may not work for these three. So we've really tried to isolate what are the core items. Some of those mentioned, for instance, the list from the auto innovators to us, a lot of their letter ties back to that drop-down menu for product components, and being able to fix that, which is a priority for the agency, would help alleviate those. The issues on the macro and the template are ones that we've also made changes to already, just have not specifically noted. So we are happy to work with folks, too, if they have specifics and let us know as we move forward. This is much like any type of software where there are enhancements made as we move along the system, whether it's updates made on the operating system for your car radio or others. Systems that are released by public and private entities.
I appreciate that answer. I'll just say we are glad that everyone's here in the same room today, and we have about 43 minutes to kind of go through additional questions, so I think everybody's going to have a chance to share their thoughts. Just on a personal level, it is a little concerning when I hear, on one hand, the presentation, and I know that PCA is working to address issues as you understand them, but I hope today's hearing will help you further understand those that are being regulated and the real challenge that they seem to be having and the timeline that they're expected to provide this information. So next I'll go to Representative Schultz.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director and Assistant Commissioner. We have heard that, let me back up and just say that as it relates to computer and state IT systems, that hasn't exactly been what Minnesota is known for, right? Minlars, countless other examples, Minsure, not good examples. We are a couple months away from this drop-dead deadline in terms of penalties, fines, and other things. And so from my understanding, from what I've heard, that PRISM's terms and conditions detail that the contractor who operates PRISM is not liable for any issues that result in lost revenue. So should PRISM fail the day before the deadline and a small business is looking and trying to comply but misses this deadline, who is held accountable?
Assistant Commissioner or Director, whoever wants that.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I can start off with that. So overall, it goes to our enforcement strategy in general. On day two, we are not going out there looking to open up compliance cases. We're going to work with folks to be able to see what can be done. If there were to be an issue with the overall system, we would take that in consideration as we move forward to it. If the system for some reason is not operating, is not available, that will be a reason for us as we look into our considerations and give folks additional time if needed. There's ability to do that as we move forward.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to hear that, especially hearing from the testifiers today, the fact that there wasn't a whole lot of meaningful correction before the hard launch. And so I'm just going to ask it very specifically to you, because there's a lot of interests at play, from small businesses to those who've been working diligently with your organization, with your agency. Will the MPCA enforce the penalty for missing the deadline in the event the website fails due to being overwhelmed with data?
Assistant Commissioner. Director.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And for the record, Tom Johnson, Government Relations and External Affairs for the PCA. The agency has a long history, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, of first working directly with the manufacturer and not taking a penalty approach. We've had non-compliance issues with food packaging, with flame retardants, with lead and cadmium over time, and all of those we've been able to resolve without going to penalties. So I do not anticipate we will need to use that authority. It remains in place in case there are examples of non-compliance that are intentional and where folks are not complying either repeated or intentionally. So the agency also has the authority in Amara's law to extend the date. We have already done that to allow additional time for folks to work through the system. Just to be clear, the soft launch was not the only testing period. That was a targeted approach with a few folks that we knew would have complex products, and we wanted to address their issues. But we're in the beta test. We're in the testing period right now. We have 5 months for folks to make for us to make changes in response to folks' feedback, and that's exactly what we're doing by the end of February with launch 1.1, and then again we'll be making another update updates as needed until July 1st.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a closing statement on this topic, that based upon the testimony from the people who are working with you in good faith, that there has been inconsistent guidance from your agency. And so I'm glad to hear what you said, but let's work towards being consistent in our guidance. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner and Director. Kind of along those same lines, thinking of, you know, as somebody's trying to comply and filling in and, you know, the technical support that may be required, what do you have for the ability to be able to help, you know, navigate some of these? And I think it's a system that sounds to be evolving with the drop-down menus and the but at the same time, you know, technology can be frustrating sometimes. So can you answer a little bit about technical support and what that looks like?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, so we have a few different assistant mechanisms. We have our user guide that's created, frequently asked questions, documents that are out there that are produced to be able to walk folks through and answer some of the larger questions that are out there that we're seeing. And those are updated, as mentioned by Director Johnson, as we get different situations folks present themselves with. It's the, you know, natural enhancement of the system. We then have a number of different individuals that can help answer questions too. The system itself is run by organization. They have folks that can help answer questions. We have our staff that can help answer questions, whether it's some of our business solutions folks or the program staff that are working directly with PFAS and products. So there are a couple different avenues there to be able to help answer various questions we have.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you for that. And I think it sounds like, you know, we're on the right step with that. But, I just wrote down some notes here during the various presentations, and sounds like there's a lot of components, and you know, some of them might be very fairly simple to get the answer to, and others are, you know, and I don't know if we know how many users are going to be interfacing with using this. So do you feel that you have that it's going to be a big enough tech support to be able to handle this?
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Johnson, MPCA. The staff that we have working on this site, at least one has also worked from a couple of different Fortune 500 companies with really complex products and product lines of over 1,000. So we have some of that expertise in-house. And I think we're pretty confident that that we can address the issues that come in. To answer your question about how many users, we estimated in the rulemaking documents that there would be between 5,000 and 10,000 manufacturers submitting. The ALJ felt that the administrative law judge felt that was a reasonable estimate. And so that's the estimate that we've been operating under. So we're certainly built the system with a compatibility at that larger end. And but anything that's coming within that range would be certainly workable. Also want to I think the assistant commissioner mentioned this, but this is built upon a system called the High Priority Chemicals Database system. I think I got that right. And that is a system that folks have been using for years in California, Oregon, and many other states to report chemicals. So we believe the functionality. It's the same company providing this software. So while there are changes needed to accommodate the breadth of PFAS and the breadth of products under Amara's law, we're confident that the system itself, the underlying bones, is capable of handling it.
Director, not seeing any more questions from Representative Nelson. I'm just going to put on your radar. Curious, you've mentioned a couple of times that this is a off-the-shelf product to some extent, that there's other states using the same software. I'll later be wondering why the issues that we're hearing, if that's the case. Next is Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you again. My questions are a little farther back in the slide program. On the projects, the $25 million, 14 grant projects, the $4.5 million, could you provide the committee with the list of those projects, the amounts, the locations, where they're at, who got what, when, when they were completed?
Director.
Mr. Chair, happy to provide that to the committee. Yeah.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, second follow-up question. Commissioner Johnson, you had mentioned about the application of biosolids and that the monitoring of the site where the biosolids are produced and looking at the biosolid production. Has the MPCA done any monitoring of the sites where the biosolids have been applied for many years? Let's say there is a farm location where they may have been applied for the last 30 or 40 years, and therefore, even though it may be low levels, the persistent forever chemicals have been accumulating over those 30 or 40 years.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The answer of testing of sites with historic land application is no. I don't believe we've done any of that. We do have, a project that was approved by LCCMR that will be looking at soil background levels across many different sites. I will be looking at background levels. Is the intent of that project? Happy to provide more detail on that project, but I don't believe we've gone to any specific site that we know there's been historic application and tested that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. Is there any opportunity for a landowner or a farmer who may be concerned for them to be able to do their own testing where, on the market, or what would that cost, or is there something under your existing authority where you could respond to a request for a voluntary exam?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that is a good question. I know that in cases where I believe that as part of our strategy, when there is an exceedance of the values that we've set in each of the tiers, that there would be a notification of the landowner where the biosolids are applied, and they get to make that that determination for themselves whether they want to accept that free fertilizer. But my understanding is the cost of a sample is fairly significant. It's about $250 to $500 for folks to do a sample themselves and send it in. I believe that wouldn't be us, the MPCA, doing that testing. It would be a third-party lab.
Representative Hansen.
If the environmental fund or the remediation fund would be allowable expense for paying for voluntary testing of biosolids on farmland.
Mr. Herman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't know if it specifically would be authorized. It would be within the agency's purview, and I don't know if they think they have the authority at this point in time or not. I could get back to you, look into it a little bit more, and get back to you.
Representative Hansen.
Do you have the authority?
Director.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My understanding is we do not have the statutory authority set up to just provide funding to landowners to do sampling. If the remediation fund, for example, we would need to see and do a site assessment, see an issue there before we would be able to spend remediation funds. Similarly, the environmental fund, aside from some specific uses, does not have many statutory appropriations for us to use that money. It's the legislature that appropriates to us, even though those revenues come in as part of various MPCA programs.
Representative Hansen, I would like to know the answer to that question conclusively also, so I think that's something we all need to work on offline, if that's okay.
Chair, I'm sorry to throw you off there. One other thing I'd like to toss out as you're looking at that part of it is when you're looking at it in the ground, is if there's a way to start extending out, if it's showing up there, is it being uptaken into the grains or the products that are being done off of that? I think there needs to be that tie-in. I'm starting to jump in there, but I felt that.
No, that's totally okay. Thank you for mentioning that. Representative Woolross.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman and Assistant Commissioner Director. Gentlemen, first question, I have a couple questions, Chair. First question, pretty simple, just curious. The soft launch participants, how were they chosen?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we had a number of folks who volunteered through conversations in the rulemaking that if we needed help through that process, we've asked for a number of groups, including larger groups like the chamber and that, if they had folks that they would like to suggest. And so we did that. We opened it up and said we would open up for some names, a small group, and then during a period, the week of December 15th, we would get back to those folks to bring them into the system.
Representative Woolross.
Very good. Just a little follow-up here, and this is maybe two-tiered and a bit more of a statement. I know in other government realms, duplicate data entry is a long and costly process. I know it happens a lot in county realms and human health services. And I'm wondering, is the PRISM system duplicative of any other reporting that the MPCA does?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is not data that the agency or other state agencies collect at this time.
Okay. Follow-up to that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Woolworth.
Thank you. Is just how similar or different are these databases in states that have reporting? Are you coordinating with any other states at all?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're using the Interstate Clearinghouse portal so that others can be using this in the future. Minnesota will be the first to have this, but other states such as New Mexico and Maine would be having to do this in the future, and we're having conversation with them to use the same portal for PFAS reporting specifically, but as mentioned earlier, Washington and Oregon use it for other chemicals of high concern with children's products. So it is something that as states we have tried to build out so that others can use it. We're not creating individual databases in each state, so manufacturers have multiple. They have this one database they can use.
Okay. All right, thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Eisman, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner and Director. Just Representative Schultz kind of covered what I was talking in some degree, but I want to go back to the drop-down boxes and the compounds that are missing on the report and the drop-down list. If a manufacturer or someone trying to report can't find that, and you talk about entering it manually, correct? Is that what I understood? You've talked about the thousands of chemicals we don't even know necessarily as a manufacturer. Maybe what if you don't know exactly what PFAS might be in a part, or you've got a boat manufacturer, a car manufacturer, as we've heard, with thousands of parts. What if you miss one? And I'm just curious on the there's a big learning curve here, and I'm just I want to be sure that there's a little bit of grace provided for manufacturers trying. I know Ms. Strandy mentioned, you know, the manufacturers claiming that there's a failure to a Mars line. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. I think everybody wants to clean up the PFAS mess, right? So I'm hoping that the enforcement actions will kind of be relative to our learning curve here. And I'm wondering if you could just reiterate that.
Assistant Commissioner, and I think part of this is because while there might be other states that have this technology or this tool, PRISM, we're also hearing of other states, those same states, having delays and other implementation issues. So if that could help, we'd appreciate an answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I can answer a couple pieces. Your example of a manufacturer that knows PFAS is present, but not the exact name, or they're not finding on the drop-down menus. There's a couple different pieces. Our frequently asked questions actually runs through this exact scenario. The person can put PFAS present, but unknown at this time. So they can put that in there. Their due diligence is they will have to continue to work with their supplier to get that information as they move forward, so they're allowed to do that. If they do know PFAS, for instance, and it's not on the drop-down menu, they can contact us, and we will be able to work with our contractor to put that on there so it's available in the very near future for them. That's an easier fix. On the component side, it was a good suggestion that we heard from the complex product manufacturers about moving away from a drop-down on those components to a you can fill in the box, because there are, you know, people have different customizable components in that. And that is a really good suggestion. We're making that, and that would be in the update at the end of the month. In general, about the reporting, as we've mentioned here again, our first piece is education and outreach. The first day afterwards, we are not looking to open up in compliance and enforcement efforts. Instead, we're going to continue educating folks as they move through this process. We understand that not every report is going to be perfect, and that's why we provided these opportunities here for them to make those updates as we continue to do and continue to move forward. Our history is working with folks to bring them into compliance, and as mentioned earlier, we are unaware of any chemical and product penalty that's been assessed, even in laws that are much older, because we are first and foremost looking for the cases of getting people into compliance and helping the manufacturers in that regard.
Assistant Commissioner, I think we all appreciate hearing you say that. The issue that I hear in the back of people's minds, especially just considering their questions, is if you're not going to be enforcing on day one, it sounds as though there's some kind of arbitrary or unknown timeline that y'all may have, but the rest of the world might like to know when does that happen, and there's concern there. Representative Burkle.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick follow-up. I just want to talk about the currently unavoidable use part of this, and I'm curious, and maybe Mr. Wagner wants to speak, but I'm concerned, you know, maybe from the food manufacturing side of this situation, you know, certain valves, ammonia valves, valve seats, seals, gaskets, whatnot. I'm just curious. That's a rulemaking process. Could you explain, just sure, for my refreshment, on currently unavoidable use?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, Tom Johnson with PCA. The reporting systems are not making a determination of what is essential or anything. That will be the next step here for the currently unavoidable use. So right now for the reporting, everybody needs to report anything that has intentionally added PFAS in it if they're going to sell it in Minnesota. The next step, and I think it will lead well from the reporting, people will report the function of those products. And based on that function, in the future, as we develop the rulemaking, they will be able to make a case for what is essential, what has no alternative that is viable, or what is, you know, meets that criteria that we're going to do a lot of work to flesh out, which is essential for health, safety, or the functioning of society. There's a lot there that could be determined. So there'll be a lot of work in the near future to determine what exactly fits those criteria.
Chair Burkle. One quick just follow-up. That's good to hear. Thank you. Thank you for that, Director. I think it's just crucial everybody understands that in certain situations there might be a need. And I specifically talk about ammonia systems at a processing plant, for instance. You don't want to have an ammonia leak in your city. Those kinds of situations, whether it's medical, whether it's food manufacturing, or there is critical areas where we need to consider that. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Members, I'm just going to quick name off the members on the list. It's Purcell, Gilman, Finke, Gefeld, and Fisher, Jacob, Godfrey, excuse me. I won't fault Ms. Zipko's writing. I just misread. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one comment and one question. I want us to zoom out for a second, and I want to thank all of the testifiers who came here today. That feedback makes our being first in the nation and setting the bar for the planet, it makes our process stronger. So I appreciate that you all, you know, are hearing this feedback. Hopefully the 1.1 version incorporates some of those things. But to zoom out from the portal, to have Nora Strandy here today and remembering 3 years ago having the privilege to meet your sister and your father, Michael, and continuing that work in her honor and her memory. The reason we're doing this work is to prevent more teenagers from dying. The reason we're doing this work is to protect taxpayer dollars, because it's cheap to pollute and it's expensive to clean up. Not even taking into account human life and suffering. So yes, the process, we want to get the process right. But I'm so proud that Minnesota can be a global leader in this issue that industry knew about and didn't share for longer than I've been alive. And so I want to make sure that Minnesotans get what we deserve, which is a clean environment. And I'm really grateful for everyone who is coming in good faith to make sure that this happens. Now, zooming back in to the portal and the reporting process, I mean, I do think Minnesotans have a right to know some of this information. And so some of the questions about what's proprietary, what's public, I guess I'm really curious, you know, if committee members will get to see a report, sort of like what your intention is with the folks who are having to report on the portal, and or if that is still not determined yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the determinations, folks will have to assert that those are trade secret. The agency has a long history of dealing with confidential business information, and we'll always be consistent in that approach. So the information comes in. It has to be published by an affirmative click of a button. So we will make, if somebody requests, we will look through the information and determine, some of that some of those factors are in state law already under the Data Practices Act. Some of them are in our rules that recently published, but ultimately it will be a combination of those factors. And I think an example would be if somebody creates a proprietary PFAS chemical for a very narrow and specific use that is only for their product, and it would create a competitive disadvantage for them to disclose the exact formula of that chemical, or if the name of the chemical is so clear as to exactly how it was formulated, that might be a situation where we would look at that. But those are pretty rare cases where somebody has such a specific use or a specific chemical that it would be considered confidential business information. But we do deal with that and have a long history of dealing with that.
Yeah. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner and Director. So I'm going to just come at it from a manufacturer lens here. Our family owns a manufacturing company. And just in central Minnesota alone, there's about, I would say, probably 1,200 manufacturing companies just in that area where I live. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of parts. And we have to do lots of things to maintain all the different laws and regulations in the state of Minnesota. What if we cannot obtain, or manufacturing companies cannot obtain supplier data from other countries or other areas or other states? I know we've talked about that just briefly. But again, how would that compliance be evaluated through your system?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, so we do allow for the inputting if that information is not known. I gave an example, for instance, of the chemical name. The advice that we're giving to folks too through the frequently asked questions is to continue to have record keeping on how they're doing that work. How are they communicating? What type of responses they're getting from folks, so that we can look at that as we move into the future and see what their situation holds. We understand that there are some reports will not be perfect on day one. And for instance, we could see someone who has 95% of the data. They have a record showing I contacted these folks on this schedule. This is the data I collected. That will be taken into consideration versus someone who maybe just wrote them the day before it was due. That type of information is very helpful as we look to how do we handle cases moving forward in terms of the data there. The one really good piece about the work here in Minnesota and other states is suppliers and others are collecting this information and know that there's demand for it, whether it's here or in Europe, to have their manufacturers. So that information is growing every day. And that's a good piece there where it will be more available for individuals. In addition, this database will be a resource for those next manufacturers too. So if they're buying an O-ring, they can go up after July 1st and report it to see maybe that O-ring has PFAS or not. So they can make that determination so they don't have to report in the future if they use a different O-ring. So I think the database, getting it into the database is one piece, and we talked about a little bit of that, but the database is also going to help others in the future as they produce products.
Members, we have about 11 minutes, and we still have Finke, Godfrey, and Fisher, Jacob. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, testifiers. Thank you, all the testifiers who came today. I just want to ask a question about we cannot clean our way out of this, right? Mr. Kudelka, you said that we cannot clean our way out of this problem. What is the rate of new PFAS contamination in our environment versus the rate at which we are able to clean up PFAS contamination?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, unfortunately, there's not a good number on that. A lot of the work that we do in our remediation and the sites that were mentioned earlier where we have drinking water issues are legacy issues. our work on monitoring and building it into the permits so that, for instance, whether it's a landfill or a plating company or that, that's where we're going to get that information to be able to say, where are we seeing, whether it's air emissions or water discharges with PFAS. So we'll have that better understanding of where exactly it is entering into the system. We just don't have that number today. The issue of this pollution prevention is really how do we get to the end game, right? Right now it feels, our staff, it feels like whack-a-mole. We find a new place that's contaminated. Maybe it's from something recent or from decades ago, and those just keep compounding until we can actually get ahead of that through things like Amara's Law. We're going to keep being in that cycle, and we just want to break the cycle.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that answer. You know, like Rep. Purcell, I want to just back up a little bit and just remind folks that we're in a very familiar corporate cycle where we know something is terrible for the world and corporations keep that data private until the world is dependent upon that which is poisoning the earth, right? We did this with tobacco, did this with burning fossil fuels. We're doing it with PFAS. There are 5,000 active lawsuits against 3M right now regarding PFAS. We know they knew long before I was born what this was going to do, and they did it. And now we are in a position, as Rep. Burkle said, where we have no substitute for the products, right? We must have it. And what we know, it's poisoning us and the earth and the water, but the drop-down menus are very inconvenient.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, I appreciate the larger context of this. You know, I come from this from the perspective of, we know industry is going to do whatever is going to best benefit their profit margin. And so it's incumbent upon legislatures to provide some protections for the people. And then it's on the executive branch to be able to interpret those laws that we pass and provide the technical support required for those that we are regulating to comply. And so with that context in mind, some of the things that I did hear were concerning specifically around the outlay or the provision of technical assistance and support. I think there was a reference to certain emails not getting responded to at all, things being left unread for a very, very long time. This kind of speaks a little bit to Representative Nelson's point earlier. So I would very simply ask, does MPCEA feel comfortable or confident, I should say, with the level of resources that they have right now to administer this program effectively starting July 1st? And if not, what additional resources do you need?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the system is up and running. It is functional. We've received our first two reports through it. I think there's always a wish on many parties for more individual attention. But with the resources the legislature has given us, we've produced a system that will operate. We have folks at hand at MPCA to help answer some questions. We have folks at the Interstate Clearinghouse, which operates it, to be able to do that. I think it's always a hard question to say what is the exact amount for that customer service versus being able to produce more general pieces. So it's hard to answer that question.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. I would just also flag that I would personally say that your timeline is not July 1st for it to be up and run functional, because there is a point to be made that others need to adapt their systems to you and what you have done. And so there, I would just make the comment that I would encourage that this system be fully functional and ready to be used for its full intended purpose well before July 1st. And again, I would ask to receive information and maybe offline if there is additional support that's required to do that, so that we can protect folks like Amara Strandi in the future. That is our responsibility, and so I would ask that if there is additional support required for that, that you let us know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hainsman. Certainly share the concern about the state implementing technology, thinking back, of course, to Minlars, and coming from a county commissioner position here currently, counties looking for help in health and human services with outdated technology. So a real concern there. But my specific question here is going to be, inevitably, we're going to have participants here who are going to ask for extensions. So I'm wondering if you could explain to me what that process would look like and how long it would take.
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Tom Johnson, MPCA. There is in the rule a process for folks to request a 90-day extension if they're having trouble meeting the requirement on the date on the required data reporting. My understanding is that request needs to be made at least 30 days in advance, and that is I believe we'll be laying out that process and guidance for folks as well. But there is a process for requesting an additional extension on an individual basis, and folks will need to make that request to the agency and justify why they're having problems. And those may be absolutely legitimate issues. So we'll evaluate those on a case-by-case basis.
Representative Jacob.
I think the answer was you don't really know how long it would take. Case-by-case basis. I mean, the question was, how long would that process take?
Director.
Mr. Chair, I think the reason why we've laid it out with 30 days in advance of the reporting date is so we can have 30 days to look at it. So that's what I believe how long it will take to process multiple requests. Many of them will be, I assume, for the same or similar reasons.
Director, I think that the question that Representative Jacob is driving at is you have a deadline July 1st, and you start having major crashes. If that were to be the case, because it's happened in the past, there's other examples, we don't have to go through them. You're 2 weeks out or what have you, closer than your expectation in terms of formulating a complaint or a request, rather. How are you going to handle those things? If I could, Representative Jacob. Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Kirk Adelka for the record. If the system goes down entirely, the agency can move the date back without going through the extension process. For those broad situations that affect all those that are into the system, we can make those pieces. The extension component there is if there are unique things for that individual company or that may play into it. So we have a couple different options. I just want to, you know, get back to, because it's come up a couple times, the specific situation where if the computer system were to go down entirely for 2 weeks, the agency can react to that for everyone without them having to file an extension.
Representative Jacob, anything further?
I just say, having been on the receiving end of having to meet different application deadlines over the years, seems like a bit of a double standard that the state, if it needs extended amount of time, can get it, but you can bet that if the applicant needs to meet a certain deadline and everything's working good on the state ends, that applicant is going to have to meet that deadline. It's frustration.
Members, I think that we have miraculously arrived at just a few moments before our time would come to a close. I'd like to thank PCA. I'd like to thank all those that came to share with the committee their concerns and their thoughts on all of the elements of the implementation of this law. And I appreciate all the members as well and their contribution to the conversation. We are adjourned.